Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Kalief Broder's death brings up important questions about the criminal justice system in the United States. He was incarcerated on Rikers Island for 3 years without a trial. 3 years filled with delayed court appearances, continued coercion to plead guilty in solitary confinement, all over an alleged stolen backpack. A crime he maintained he was innocent of until his death. State lawmakers introduced a bill at the end of the session called Kalief's Law, which attempts to address loopholes in the speedy trial clock. Professor Allison Redlich joins us today to discuss the Browder case and related issues of the criminal justice system. She studies police and military interrogation methods and their potential to produce false confessions as well as false guilty pleas and Alford pleas. We want you to join our conversation today. This is going to be a very interesting program. You want to get in on it, do it early. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Professor Redlich, what a privilege. I understand we're losing you to the very prestigious George Mason University, where you're going next. Congratulations on that move.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, it's great. So let me start by asking you, how come this humongous conviction rate, which we have in this state, is almost always based on confessions?
By confessions, do you mean plea bargains?
Yes.
It's an astounding rate that about 97% of convictions, both in federal courts and in state courts, are the result of plea bargains. It's been said that a lot of the power has been displaced to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor holds all the cards and is able to charge high, offer very enticing plea bargains. And that's one of the big reasons why since the 1970s, 1980s, we've seen this trend where there's very, very few trials in federal courts and state courts. And in Kalief Browder's case in the Bronx, in the original article that appeared in the New Yorker, his case took place in the Bronx, and they're cited that about 4,000 cases ended in a plea bargain there in 1 year, but only 165 went to trial.
Wow. Well, I once took one of my New Paltz classes down, and we were permitted to sit there while they were doing the deals.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. You know, guys say, it was like you were bargaining over a pair of shoes. And,
yes.
and so I would say, the DA would say, we're prepared to give you 10 years. And the guy would say, three. And he'd say, how about eight? You know, it was wild.
Yeah. And again, the prosecutor holds all of the bargaining chips. The defense attorney and the defendant really don't have much leverage at all in these kind of situations. And it's anything of value can be bargained over. So typically it's the sentence length. So how many years in jail or prison you'll get, or often time served to get out of jail. It could be the number of charges, the severity of the charges. But there's many other things. A lot of the facts of the case that you can bargain down. So, you know, you may no longer be convicted of murder. It may be manslaughter, or it may not be a sex offense that would require you to register as a sex offender. It may be a lower offense that would avoid the person having to register. I don't think people, in my opinion, in my research that I've been doing over the years, I don't think people appreciate the number of rights that they're giving up when they enter into a guilty plea.
Huge
number. All the trial safeguards, the safeguards that are built into the trial process, are what you're giving up. The prosecutor doesn't even have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt when you have a guilty plea in place.
So if you were the empress or emperor,
I am.
and you could make changes, what would be at the top of your list?
Everybody says that we can't do away with plea bargaining. So I think abolishing plea bargaining completely is off the table. Everybody says that our whole system would collapse and we couldn't do without. So a lot of the reforms that are put forward have to deal with improving the indigent defense system. Mm-hmm. About 80% of defendants rely on the public defender system, indigent defense system. And as many people are aware, that system is vastly under-resourced and underfunded. Some defense attorneys get paid a flat fee for their cases and giving them incentives to plead more and more cases and not take them to trial. So one of the places I would definitely start is to provide more resources to the public defenders and reduce their caseloads. The American Bar Association recommends that defender caseloads be about 150 cases at a time, but most or many defenders have caseloads that are much, much larger than that, again, necessitating the need for plea bargaining.
I want to go, Allison Redlicker, to a different place right now, and that is inside the jail cell. I know you've done some work on that, too. Is solitary confinement, what does it do to a prisoner?
Well, to clarify, I haven't studied solitary confinement myself, but I have taught on it some, and I do know that all of the research has negative effects. I haven't seen any research that there are any positive effects of solitary confinement, especially when you're handling juveniles. In Kalief Browder's case, he spent about two-thirds of his time at Rikers in solitary confinement, and according to Kalief himself, before he sadly committed suicide, he, you know, was claiming to have flashbacks and a lot of, I think, mental health problems that originated from the solitary confinement.
All over a backpack.
All over a backpack and I think what's really interesting about this case is that we would not know anything about Kalief Browder if it wasn't for his unwillingness to plead guilty. If he had pled guilty, we never would have heard about him. But because he wanted his day in court and he insisted on having his trial, he spent over 1,000 days in Rikers only to have the case then dismissed because the prosecution was unable to prove its case.
1-800-348-2551. 1-8 is fascinating, Allison. 1-800-348-2551 for anybody who wants to get in on this. And so the criminal justice system, is, as you say, is all on the side of the prosecutor because they have so many tools to work mm-hmm. with. If the allocation of scarce resources comes down to they have them, and the other guys, the defenders, are kept basically poor and out of the game. That's the problem, right?
Yes, that's a large part of the problem. The state certainly has more resources. Certainly in large urban areas like New York City, you're going to find prosecutors with very large caseloads as well, but they're certainly more resourced than defense attorneys. Another place where prosecutors have a lot of powers with mandatory minimum sentences, and they just, you know, they hold all of the cards. They can make very enticing offers, even to people who are innocent of the crimes. And again,
Let me stop you there. Do you think very quickly? Do you think, because we got to take a break? But do you think many people are innocent who go to jail?
That is the million-dollar question. Nobody can answer that question because what I always like to say is if we were able to point to people and say, you are innocent and you are guilty, then we would not have a problem with wrongful convictions. So because we can't readily identify people who are innocent, we don't know the prevalence, but we suspect it's much, much higher than presently is known. And with guilty pleas, it serves to hide wrongful convictions.
Okay, we're going to take a very short break.
Sure.
Just a couple of seconds. By the way, I'm delighted to have you here with us. You are really good at this. So thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors. Serving the Northeast since 2001, stonesoupconcrete.com and on Facebook. Habitat Post and Beam, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, designing and manufacturing energy-efficient post and beam homes and additions throughout the Northeast since 1972. postandbeam.com. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Fulton County Tourism in the Southern Adirondack Park, fishing on their 44 lakes, camping, hiking, biking, boating, and summer events. 44 lakes, 44 choices, 44lakes.com. SPAC, presenting the 38th annual Fryhofer's Saratoga Jazz Festival, featuring Erica Badu, Maze featuring Frankie Beverly, Sheila E., Aldi Miola, Electric Band, Cassandra Wilson, and more. June 27th and 28th, SPAC.org for tickets. And Great Camp Sagamore, a national historic landmark at Racket Lake in the Adirondacks. Open for accommodations, tours, and events since 1897, GreatCampSagamore.org.
And we are back. Thank you, Zach Malloy, and thank you, Susan Chekai, for answering our phones today. It's just really great. Our guest is Allison Redlich, professor now at SUNY at Albany, soon to be at in the School of Criminal Justice, soon to be at George Mason. Their gain is our loss. Let us go to David in Paterson, New York. All right, David, you're on.
Thank you. I'd like to make a comment, if I could. I think the only confessions that should be allowed are confessions that are made in open court. Treason is the only crime defined in the Constitution. To convict using confession for treason requires the confession be made in open court. I think that standard should apply to all criminal cases. Then you throw out this nonsense, you know, jailhouse snitches. Even videotaping confessions, you may not record the coercion that was applied before the taping started. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay, hold on, David. Hold on. We may have something to say about that. Nelson?
Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I...
Doesn't everybody have to allocute at some point and say, I did it or not did it, didn't do it?
Sometimes the judge will require that and sometimes not. For a guilty plea to be valid, there has to be a factual basis of guilt. So oftentimes the person's willingness to plead guilty serves as a proxy. Just it's if they're willing to plead guilty, they're willing to then admit their guilt. I think, though, that there are also problems with confessions in open court. I mean, my understanding and the research that I've done is by the time that the defendant is standing before the judge and the plea has already been negotiated, and the confession at that point in time is more or less rehearsed and already played out by that point. And I don't know how valid the confessions are at that point, and that the same factors that you might see in an interrogation setting aren't also present behind the scenes in the plea bargaining setting, and that there might be coercion and things of that nature. So I'm not sure that just having it in open court would reduce all of the problems, I think, that there are with some confessions.
David, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. I understand what you're saying, sure. But I'm talking about a different case. Often a person will come in the court and say, I really didn't confess. I mean, you think about what happened with the Central Park Five.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were coerced into confessing, and they later repudiated it. So I understand the situation you're talking about, but I'm talking about something different. Where the person who's accused repudiates the confession, and I think you'd get rid of all that ambiguity by requiring a confession to be valid to be made in open court.
Okay. Thank you, David. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Ken in Tivoli. Ken, you're on.
Hi.
Hi, Ken.
Why don't we just call a spade here? I mean, this is a vicious system. You know, it is vicious. And if somebody comes from the wrong side of the tracks and they don't have financial resources and they find themselves in this system, they are treated like garbage and they are ground up and spit out. Why don't we just admit it and stop pretending there's anything even vaguely legitimate about this? This guy's story is just one of thousands all over the country. We saw it in Ferguson. The whole town ran on creating false charges against people and fining them and giving them penalties and then throwing them in jails because they didn't have the money to pay. I mean, we got a really bad problem here. It goes beyond academic talk.
Mm-hmm. Professor?
Well, I mean, it's an empirical question. I certainly think that a lot of the evidence that we've been seeing in these cases definitely points to that. Certainly, if you go in and you observe court hearings, you find that that is the case. And that's one of the problems with plea bargaining, again, which I just have to emphasize, account for 97% of convictions. But what the plea bargain process does is it happens in secret. It happens behind closed doors. It's what they say, it happens in the halls of justice. So there's no transparency. And I think that is one of the major problems that needs to be addressed. That all of the what we see on TV, this adversarial system that we're supposed to be having, where the prosecution and the defense are dueling it out in open court, is just largely a myth because we have such a system that relies so heavily on plea bargaining.
I just wanted to add one thing, and that was you mentioned the Central Park group. And what's interesting about that one is those kids were told that if they pleaded guilty, they could go home.
The dirty tricks that police play on the poor and the young, I mean, it's appalling, and it's a daily occurrence all over the country. It's woven right into our so-called system mm-hmm. of criminal justice. And, you know, we are going to pay for it, and we do pay for it. Something, sure. But, you know, we are alienating millions of people who otherwise could have been productive members of society for nothing so that a cop can get a little gold star at the end of the month for his arrest, so that a prosecutor, remember, these are careerists. The more people they find guilty, the more their stock rises. The judges are getting paid. The court officers are getting paid. It is kind of a second form of slavery. There's no chains, but everybody's getting paid, and the poor people are getting ground into the dirt.
Well, Ken, you've had your say. I appreciate your call very much, and we got a lot of people behind you, so we're going to let you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan.
Right. Let's go to Marta in Pottown, Poughkeepsie. You're on, Marta.
Hi, Dr. Shartok, and your guest. What the man just said from Tivoli, he's really right on, and what we've got going here, we all know, is called the prison industrial complex. And people are raised from early childhood to actually be steered right into that life, depending on whether or not their parents are incarcerated. The majority of the crimes are nonviolent. And, you know, we see this scene where these two guys are on the run right now, that a CEO was involved, at least one. And I think at $1 million a day, actually, it's quite a profitable event. You know, now $14 million later, they still haven't caught these guys. And from what I heard from a friend who has done time in that prison. It's an extremely cruel prison. And there's corrections officers in there who, if you don't have any family or friends keeping an eye on you, you're targeted for death. And they do put people to death inside prison. You know, there's an awful lot of suicides and very ill people in there who never come home alive. And, you know, I know people who've been incarcerated that died of scleroderma. Whoever heard of that? What's going on in there? It's a nightmare all over this country, and it's really a sad commentary on our supposedly advanced civilized civilization, where we spend $60,000 to incarcerate someone instead of send them to college or give them a equal opportunity in this world. And what color are most of the people in prison?
Marta, thank you very much for your contribution.
Thank you, Dr. Shartok.
Thank you, Marta. Okay. 1-800-348-2555. 1-2 free phones. We'll go to Julian in New Paltz. Okay. Julian, you're on.
Hi. I just had a quick question about solitary confinement.
Yep.
When somebody's put in solitary confinement, do they get put in, like, the same kind of room as everybody else? Or what's the difference with the room?
Well, again, I'm no expert here, but my understanding is they're in a room by themselves, and they're in the room for 23 hours a day, and they get to leave the room for 1 hour a day, and they get fed in that room, and They may have other privileges depending on the circumstances, like phone calls or along those lines. But again, it's a little bit outside of my area of expertise.
You know, the great, is it Julian? Is that your name?
Yeah.
Julian. The great liberal politician, Mario Cuomo, who I had on the air for 18 years, once got into a conversation with me, and he, quite frequently, as you remember, he was adamantly opposed to the death penalty. And he would say every once in a while, we're going to look, people would rather die. They're saying, execute me rather than put me into solitary confinement. And he'd say the only thing they're going to hear is the sound of the toilet seat going up and down on the toilet for the rest of their lives. As if, and he was sort of making the argument that that was what happened when somebody had murdered somebody else. So that was interesting, even coming from one of the great social political liberals in the country. Doesn't call for comment from anybody. Julian, thanks for the call.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Ray in Great Barrington. Okay, Ray, you're on.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can. We can hear you.
Okay, great. I've been a prosecutor and a defense attorney. I'm licensed in New York and Mass. I think it'd be a good idea if all the judges in New York and in the town court had to be lawyers before they could be judges in New York. That doesn't necessarily need to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
So when you actually have a case where you want to fight something on constitutional grounds, they sort of look at you and say, well, what are you talking about? So it's pretty hard mm-hmm. to get your rights protected in town court in New York State, and that's all throughout the state. They need to get rid of minimum mandatory sentencing because that gives all the bargaining power to the prosecution. As your guest has said already, and the problem is there aren't any really easy answers because the system is under resourced on all sides probably, and there are so many cases that come through that everybody sort of just wants to rush them through and take care of them as quickly as possible, and that's why we get these plea bargains that your guest was talking about. You know, we need to probably change the laws. If we got rid of the minimum mandatories, then we probably wouldn't. We take away a lot of that leveraging power on the part of the prosecution.
Ray, what would the political impetus for doing that be? In other words, you say get rid of the minimum. So what?
Yeah, it's tough because the populace they want tougher laws. They want people put away. They want more people monitored, and we also want to forget about them. So we don't put the money in as well, and that's a real problem.
And to say nothing, of course, one of my favorite topics is putting these prisons up at the Canadian border when the population comes from the major metropolitan area, New York City.
Yeah, exactly.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that definitely is a problem as well because, family wants to visit their loved ones, and that makes it all that much tougher.
Sure, and makes those people who are incarcerated a little bit more desperate, perhaps. Okay, Ray, thank you for your very good call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Oh, yeah, okay. We'll go to Julius. Hi, old friend. What's up?
Hi, Alan. And a couple questions. I can understand that the state probably wants to minimize the number of trials that take place because of the cost. But from the standpoint of the prosecutor and the stats on his personal career, doesn't the number of convictions he gets essentially put him in a better light? So aren't we dealing with a double problem here? One, we want to get these done as quickly as possible, so we'll use plea bargain. But two, to the prosecutor's advantage, if he can get more convictions, that makes him look better.
Absolutely, and that certainly is a problem around the nation that conviction rates are one of the metrics of a good prosecutor. I know some prosecutors' offices are trying to change that and make it more about the charges that are brought rather than the convictions and things of that nature, but that does feed into the problem.
And how do we change that?
How do we change it about, we try and use different metrics of what makes a competent prosecutor rather than conviction rates.
Well, what's the impetus for that happening?
Yeah.
You see my, yeah. You see my point? In other words, right now there's a deal. You know, and the more you put away, the better you are.
Sure.
The more you get. But there has to be a political will to change the system, right?
Well, we have a very, very overcrowded system. You know, one
of
the
closing prisons in New York.
I'm glad to hear it. No, but yeah, I mean, we have overcrowded prisons because, in large part, because of these mandatory minimums that have produced more pleas and more people in prison. But one of my understanding is that you know, one of the metrics of judges is how efficient they are with their docket, and efficiency means moving cases along and having more plea bargaining. So it's not just a problem of more convictions for the prosecutor. I mean, there's many problems that feed into you know, it starts with the police and the number of arrests that they have. Another reform that people have put forth is having better screening processes for the prosecutors so that they're not bringing forward all of these cases, and they're getting rid of the weak cases before it even gets to a certain point, before it's indicted, before it's charged, not even a dismissal.
Okay, Julius, we're going to let you go because we got a lot of people behind you, okay?
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. We've got a Dr. White. Okay. Doctor, you're on.
Yes. Hi.
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 So a couple years back, I personally spent a year behind bars for being in possession. That was something that was somewhat distasteful but perfectly legal to have. The prosecutor came to me with a choice. He said I could either plead guilty to this one charge, or I could exercise my right to trial by jury, and that was his quote. And at which point he would file a superseding indictment, file two additional charges, which each had mandatory minimum sentences. So I was basically given a choice between, 30-something months and judicial discretion to cut my sentence, which he did by more than 50%, or about 13 years in prison for being in possession
But wait, let me ask you this. Were you not guilty?
I wouldn't consider myself guilty, and every reasonable person I've spoken to about the specifics of my case thinks it's ridiculous. But because of the way the particular laws are written, they're written in a technically very broad fashion that by the law I could be considered guilty because of how broadly this particular subject is defined.
Allison?
Yeah, I mean, what you described, my understanding, it happens all the time. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that this is constitutional. There is a very famous case in the 1970s, Borden-Kircher versus Hayes, where in that case, the prosecutor offered the defendant, he said, plead guilty for 5 years, and you'll get 5 years for he stole about $88 and change. And or if you don't plead guilty, I'm going to charge you as a habitual offender, because this was basically like three strikes. It was his third strike, which was in the prosecutor's right to do that. And you'll get life in prison if you are convicted at trial. And that's exactly what happened. He exercised his right to trial and he lost, and he was sentenced to life in prison for stealing $88. And the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that this was constitutional and that the defendant in this case had made a choice. And so hard bargaining is what they call it, is perfectly acceptable as long as the defendant has a choice. It may be a coercive choice, but it was, according to the Supreme Court, I don't necessarily agree with this, that the defendant in this case chose to take his chances at trial.
In other words, the Constitution guarantees everybody a right to a trial, but if you take the trial, you're screwed.
Yeah, I mean, the prosecutor in this case, upon appeal, had fully admitted that the only reason he was charging this defendant as a habitual offender was to induce a plea bargain.
Yeah, and to make a signal to everybody else not to fool around.
Perhaps, yeah.
Hey, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. We got to take a break.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care. CECAA.com. Emmerich Sales and Service, Charlton and South Glens Falls, locally owned and operated since 1968, featuring power equipment including Cub Cadet, Kubota, Toro, and more. EmmerichSales.com. The New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, serving the public for over 30 years. NYSBA.org/lawyer-referral. The Skidmore College Jazz Institute, presenting Tuesday and Thursday jazz nights at Zankel Music Center with the Gary Bartz Quartet and Benny Williams Quintet, June 30th through July 9th. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Cantix Construction, West Chesterfield, Massachusetts, specializing in energy-efficient, net-zero, passive house home building, deep energy retrofits, and historical restorations. Serving Western Massachusetts, CantixConstruction.com. And the Whistling Kettle Tea Room, tea shops and cafes in Ballston Spa in downtown Troy, New York. Over 170 loose-leaf teas from around the world, in-store and online. TheWhistlingKettle.com.
Here we are, back with Dr. and Professor Allison Redlich, who studies these topics we've been talking about extensively and really has brought something interesting to the table today, and many of you are calling. There is now one free phone. Let's go to Wendy in Woodstock. All right. Wendy, you're on.
Okay, hi. I'm sorry I went in somewhere. I wanted to just comment that I'm a retired New York State mental health worker and worked in the prisons. And one of the problems that I see is that combined with the stop and frisk in New York City, it's a way of getting to these young African-American boys, because they're very young, they're like 16, and then they're terrified, and so then they plead, and then you know, they go to prison, and then they're on parole, and then they get stopped again. And they're in this very dangerous cycle. And so I just wanted to comment, the system is very corrupt, starting from the Department of Corrections, and I hate to say it, the people who provide mental health.
Now, Wendy, those are two very interesting questions, so let me just intervene. I'm sorry, Allison.
Sure.
Point number one, as you say, the system is corrupt. It's corrupt because?
Because you get these kids, mostly African-Americans. If you go to any of them, I worked in a medium, everybody's African-American. You may see one white guy here and there. And what happens is you get these kids when they're young, and a lot of it has to do with the stop and frisk in New York City. So then they get arrested, and then the police get somebody to say, yeah, he's the one who stole the candy bar. And then they get arrested, then they plead. So then they do 1 to 3. Then they're out on parole, and then they go back to the same neighborhood, and they get stopped again. And it's like a vicious cycle.
So do you mean when they're stopped and they're frisked, they don't have anything on them that will get them into trouble?
A lot of times they don't.
Okay.
No, I mean, you know, we know what's going on in the cities with the stop and frisk.
Yeah, okay. But the second thing you said was also interesting to us, and that was that the mental health workers were also deficient.
You look the other way. For example, you're told that you're only allowed to admit inmates that are in medication. So that happens that 90% of the kids who are in there for trauma, and so you don't get to see them. And in 2010, the suicide rate among young African-American men doubled in the prisons, and there were hearings with the Department of the Commission on Corrections in the state, the politicians. You had a group of mothers who came, and everybody's wondering, well, if we have so much mental health in the prisons, why are these people doing that? And that's because they were not admitted into the mental health system. So if you're not in the circle, and you're not in the circle because you were not considered ill enough, but you're still traumatized, nobody's monitoring you. and everybody looks the other way. And I don't want to say too much on the radio, but I do know that a whole group of them retired in 2010, 2009, because it was just not tenable. Okay. I don't want to go in and say more. I don't want to say my name.
Sure.
But mainly I want to say that I would agree, having had personal conversations with a lot of these kids, that a lot of these kids were literally railroaded into prison because they were afraid.
Anonymous.
I could go on and on.
No, don't. We got a lot of people behind you. Anonymous in Woodstock, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Rob in Beckett. Okay, Rob, you're on. Rob? Hello? I think what happens is sometimes sometimes, Allison, just to tell you what goes on here, people, they're holding on the phone, and they think they can hear it on the radio, but the radio comes after the actual conversation. There's a seven-second delay.
Hello,
Rob. You back from the radio?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead. You're on.
I wanted to ask counsel, Allison, if we were to adopt the British system, instead of having a district attorney who has an office down the hall from the chief of police, and they kind of work hand in glove to find someone to prosecute, if we were to have just an independent system, when the police find that they have a solid case, they schedule a trial, and a barrister may be appointed by the Crown to prosecute, who may have previously been a defense attorney, and work it out that way, rather than having a district attorney at all. Would that work better in the United States, do you think?
In terms of reducing the number of plea bargaining?
Well, no, just in general, better quality of justice all across the board.
I'm not sure. I do know that neither the inquisitorial or the adversarial system is perfect. Certainly, they have their pluses and minuses. I do know that in terms of police interrogation in the United Kingdom and other European countries, they've moved from a model that is adversarial to one that's more of information gathering, and they've really done away with interrogation, as it were, and really trying to get confessions is no longer their goal. And I do think that that is an important reform. And honestly, from what I've seen here in the United States, which is obviously a lot larger than Great Britain, a lot more different states and so forth. I'm not sure we're going to be making those macro level reforms in terms of interrogation, but I do think that was a move in the right direction.
Well, thank you. You corroborated my feelings, and I appreciate your input.
Well, thank you
for calling. Addressing my question.
Thanks, Rob.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We'll go to Jeremy in Woodstock. Okay, Jeremy in Woodstock, you're on.
Hi there, everybody.
Hey, and thanks for staying by the phone. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Bob got, I think Bob and I got confused because you got preempted by a weather alert. So.
Oh, is that right? I didn't hear that in my ears. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
well, I have to kind of have it, you know, trying to split the difference between the radio and the phone. So the one thing I want to say is, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of people would be more politically active if they recognize the way things are now. I think a lot of things that we all thought were a thing of the past a long time ago, like endless solitary confinement, like debtors' prisons, things like that, we thought were battle stuff from the Industrial Revolution or from, you know, that we inherited for England, have been creeping back into the system little by little all over the country. Right now, if you go to Rikers, your average wait time for a trial is going to be 2.5 years. That means that the prosecutors aren't only using harsher sentencing as leverage, they're actually using the flaws in the system as leverage to get you to plea. Hey, you know what, you might be innocent. We might not be able to charge you with anything in the end. We might not be able to convict you of anything, but you're still going to do 2 or 3 years in jail, in a notorious jail, in general population.
Which, of course, Jeremy has just been, we are reading in the New York Times every morning, has admitted that something is seriously wrong there. It's a violent place, and a federal monitor is being installed. So, and that's been going on for a long, long time.
What's terrifying is that here and there you hear a story about this, or you hear a story about that, you hear a story about a jail. Southwest, where 5 people have died from lack of medical attention within a 2-year period, and you start to wonder, this is not a few bad apples here and there. We've got a serious problem. It's draining us of natural resources in terms of human resources. It's draining us in terms of money. It's slowing the country down.
It does make you wonder if it is a prosecution strategy, because, again, I feel strongly that with Kalief Browder's case, we would not be hearing about it if he had pled guilty. And most people in his position would have simply pled guilty to get out of jail.
Can you imagine?
I would argue that nothing's bring about it anyway unless he committed suicide, because he's one of tens of thousands that we haven't heard of.
Right.
Okay, Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now to Dick in Longmeadow. All right, Dick, you're on the phone.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My question is more if maybe someone else wants to comment on it. But I'm just wondering, is the immigration system in the country contributing partially to all these imprisonments of minorities?
I'm not sure of your question, but
no,
I don't.
No, in other words,
see this uncontrolled immigration. People coming to this country without skills, without work, and perhaps get into trouble. And that's all I'm saying is, if you go to the Scandinavian countries, there is no immigration.
Oh, I don't think that's true anymore.
In Denmark, there's no immigration. In the Netherlands, there's no immigration.
I don't know the percentage of defendants in the U.S. who are immigrants, but I don't think that our problems with crime can be attributed in large part to immigrants.
That's what I was curious about.
Yeah.
Okay. Dick, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And we'll now go to Dia in Newburgh. Dia.
Yes, good afternoon. I want to make sure that I heard the comments earlier. Did you ask the professor if innocent people are convicted? And I thought she said nobody can answer that. Is that correct?
What I said was that we can't readily identify people who are guilty and people who are innocent. Of course, we now have the Innocence Project where DNA is... Sure.
I'm sorry. That's why I was calling.
Oh, okay.
Because there are
sure.
so many people, we know hundreds, who have been released. And just recently, after the Clinton convicts escaped, they CNN interviewed a man who... had been at Clinton, that's why they interviewed him, I think,
for
25 years, and he was just released, and he
yes.
was innocent.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we want to know before they spend 25 years
yes.
and to ensure, but again, wrongful convictions via pleas, only about 10% of the exoneration cases are people who pled guilty. And that's not because guilty people or innocent people don't plead guilty. It's because of the ways that we identify people who are innocent and who have been wrongly convicted. And we rely primarily on trial transcripts and things that happen at trial, where in a plea situation, you don't have any of that record. And again, the prosecutor doesn't even have to prove their case. So you don't have all of that documentation and records to go on and to then prove the person innocent.
Dina, I'm sorry I messed up your name in the beginning.
No, thanks for
and thanks for
Thank
calling.
You.
A very important call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right.
Bye now.
Let's go to Kevin in Kingston, K-I-K. Kevin in Kingston, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I can make a knowledgeable comment about the immigration question. I'm a forensic psychiatrist, and I have had a case with an individual who was carrying a legitimate green card, but because of his mental retardation, he was never able to pass the test for citizenship. Was charged. He was offered a plea deal. He's not taking the plea deal because any guilty verdict will result in his deportation. So you are not going to see an immigrant in our prisons at this point in time, not in New York State. They're going to be deported. Very recent.
Yes. No, and in 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with the issue of deportation. And so now in a plea bargain situation, the defense lawyer has to inform the defendant, if he is an immigrant, that they will be, they could possibly be deported if they plead guilty. And but that's one of the few exceptions. That's now a direct consequence. But the Constitution does not say that we need to know about these what are called collateral consequences of plea bargains. So all of these consequences, like employment and being ineligible for student loans and public housing, that kind of refers back to the cycle that one of the other callers was talking about. A lot of people, I think, are unaware that they're going to be ineligible for these things and have and be confronted with all of these collateral consequences because they need not be made known to defendants when making that decision.
One always wonders, it's sort of interesting, faced with, let's say, life in prison or going back to where you came from, which would be preferable? In some cases, going back means you get murdered. I mean, you can't do it. So,
Possibly,
this individual was from Colombia, too. So.
Well, yeah. Hey, Kevin, thanks for the very good call. Very interesting question. Let's go to Richard in Wilton. Richard, you're on.
Hi, Doc. Real quick question regarding the double jeopardy question. Recently, or a couple of years ago, the Daryl Mouth case up in Saratoga Springs, which I'm sure everyone in the world knows about, I was a witness to that actual whole happening. I worked at one of the clubs close by. I was second one on the scene, gave my deposition, followed the case all the way through. I was never called for any follow-up, which I could have offered more information. I went there. I offered it. They said they didn't need it. Case was put to rest. Everything was judged as it was. Today's paper says that they're now reopening the case against the police department. Is that enough for some type of a double jeopardy where they've already been found innocent, but now they're going back to reopen the case?
What were the police officers or the police department, were they the defendants in the first place?
They were. It was a domestic case that happened on the street during the wee hours of the morning. They chased the suspect. He fell from a scaffolding 20 foot high. The kid's mother and family has said that the police severely beat him before he fell from the scaffolding, which was not true.
Okay, well, Richard, I wish I could tell you could have more time, but you can't. And the reason you can't is we're almost out of time. So, Allison, you have something you want to say about this?
I'm not following sometimes, that case, well, but it okay. might be civil charges
sometimes
as opposed to criminal.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes, they change the charges. Mm-hmm. In other words, they say, we're reopening it because we got different charges now than the ones
New
you
evidence.
Were found innocent
yeah.
on.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem right that they can. Well, it didn't work the first time, so let's change the wording and we'll reopen.
There's a lot about this, Richard, that doesn't seem right. Believe me, that's the whole program. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate your time.
All right, thanks, Alan. Bye bye.
Very quickly, Malta, private prisons. Melita, I'm so sorry. Melita in Wilbraham wants to know about you're thinking about private prisons and you have to do it in a sentence.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering how private prisons figure into this.
Yeah, okay.
If there's a profit involved, because they want to take young, healthy black men that don't need a lot of medical attention or dental attention.
Okay, Melita,
make more money from them.
I'm so sorry. We're out of time. Any last words on Professor?
I'd like to, the criminal justice system is a very, very complicated machine.
And
a lot
an
of people say
system.
It's a lot of people say it's corrupt. And I think a lot of reforms have to be put into place, and okay. I'll just end it there.
Okay, we are out. Thank you so much. You are wonderful, and we thank Professor Allison Redlich for joining us. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Neptune's Harvest, organic fertilizers from nutrient-rich ingredients, including fish, seaweed, and crab shell from the North Atlantic Ocean, available in bulk for farms and retail sizes for home gardening. Neptune'sHarvest.com, Cohen's Auctions, accepting consignments of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, historic items, and more. Cohens.com for appointments. The 1850 House and Tavern, an historic boutique bed and breakfast on the banks of the Roundout River for weekend getaways, retreats, and weddings. Main Street, Rosendale, New York. The 1850House.com. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York. Offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including memory care and more. Caring in the family tradition, 518-393-8800. And everybody, thanks for Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Susie Chekai. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein. She's the one who got Professor Allison Redlich, and we thank her for it. You were terrific. Good luck in your new job.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.